You must put three zombie takeout in the toad zombie takeout, and then retrieve the zombie takeout from inside his zombie takeout. Only then will the zombie takeout flourish. What's up? Welcome to episode 223 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-Moving Cult Movie Podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, just something that I noticed this past weekend that relates to a few movies we've already reviewed and one we'll be reviewing in the near future. As I mentioned last week, I bought all of the Resident Evil movies on DVD, and I marathoned them this past weekend.
You poor bastard.
I love them. They're just, you'll see when we review. They are gleefully excessive. But I noticed that the third one was directed by Russell Mulcahy.
No kidding. Oh yeah, I think we'd mentioned that in the...
Okay, if we did, it slipped my memory. I gotta say, of the Russell Mulcahy films that I've seen, which are the ones we've reviewed, it's really his finest work.
Wow.
And I'll actually go on a limb and say it's better than Highlander, and that could be expectation management. But I don't know. I think it's his best work. Judging from his IMDb... probably his best film, period. I haven't seen The Shadow. That has
I was going to say, he doesn't have a whole lot of
nothing
movie
that's good.
Credits.
No.
I mean, it's Highlander, it's Ricochet.
Mm-hmm. It's The Shadow.
Right.
Yeah. It just caught my attention this weekend. I got a kick out of it. Anyway, on to this week's movie, which is from 2006, Pan's Labyrinth. And of course, the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by The Hero's Journey. Okay, enough already. We get it.
And also brought to you by eyeballs. Please keep them inside of you at all times. So, we have this young girl and her pregnant mother taking this perilous trip across the countryside. Perilous, of course, because her mother is just that far along.
Mm-hmm.
And any travel, I mean, they usually don't want to do.
Yeah.
But... you get the impression that this has been a rocky pregnancy from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, she is married to an asshole who has determined that that she should be with him to give birth to the son rather than him being absent or go to her. Well, her father, her stepfather, I should say, since I'm going to tell this from the girl's perspective, since mm-hmm. she's the main character.
Okay.
He is a captain in Franco's army.
This takes place just after the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, yes. It's just World War II is just about wrapping up. You know, D-Day has occurred. Well, actually, I guess it wouldn't be wrapping up, but I guess...
yeah, 1944 is when it takes place.
Yeah, 44. So there's still about a year left. And yeah, they in the background, they do mention that, you know, they've landed. The Allies have landed in France, and of course, Spain was out of the conflict altogether, pretty much. But they were still under fascist control, and there were still pockets of resistance. And that is where they are. They're trying to crush any resistance to Franco, and. So that's the backdrop here.
That's kind of the B story in the movie.
Yeah. And, well, really, it is the A story, actually.
Well, yeah, it kind of starts there. I guess if you're going chronologically, that story starts first and then the other story comes in. But if you look at Ophelia as the main character, then her story would be the A story.
She, but anyway, she, while living there with the fascists, they, You realize that there are spies from the resistance within, and in the middle of all of this struggle, Ophelia, you could make two different arguments here. One, her imagination runs away with her.
Yeah, or she has a psychotic break, what have you.
Or she has a psychotic break, or she has discovered some crazy shit that is hidden for centuries.
Yeah.
I think they kind of say at the end that people question like whether what she experienced here was real or not.
I think the ending actually leaves it more open-ended than I had considered it to be throughout the movie.
I thought pretty much that it, but I guess there's enough people that are still questioning back and forth. Anyway, what we are talking about is she meets a fawn. Well, first she meets.
Not FAWN as in a small deer, but FAUN as in the half human, half deer.
Right, she meets Torgo, actually. No,
Yeah.
isn't it weird that two back to back? We had no idea we were doing this.
Except El Toro pulled off the effect.
Well, yeah, and didn't kill anybody. But we have, but she first she meets a fairy, who leads her to the fawn, and yeah, the movie title got changed for the international from the different nationality audiences what a fawn or pan is.
The original title, if I recall correctly, was something along the lines of The Labyrinth of the Fawn.
Yeah, exactly. And they were afraid that the Anglo audience would not get what a fawn is and would recognize that as Pan, even though it's clearly not Pan because there was no fucking flute. But anyway,
And I don't know if the majority of the Western audience would even know who Pan is.
yeah, so it really didn't make much sense when you're talking about mythological creatures. Most of Western audiences were going to have to look it up either way. They are going to have to Google what it was, unless they're like me that went through mythology courses and just read a ton of shit as a kid about mythology. But anyway, so we are pretty much taken into a fairy tale of some sort. And when I'm saying fairy tale, I'm talking true old school Grimm Brothers, not the Disney sanitized fairy tales that we've seen, but things that want to eat kids sort of fairy tales.
Pretty much literally at the end.
Well, right. So she is given three tasks, of course. There is always three tasks because the fact has been revealed to her that she is in fact a princess of this other realm, and to cross into it, she needs to complete these tasks. Or she's going to be stuck as a mortal forever. And it's kind of, I mean, they are, it's fantasy, but it's horrific fantasy because, I mean, the fawn is not a pleasant looking thing, This isn't Prince Charming coming to whisk her away. This is a gnarly looking pan or fawn this would have been the equivalent of Turgot coming to take her away, actually, now that I think about it. But yeah, she completes the first task, which involves a frog and vomit and whatever. She completely fucks up the second task. She has to take an
She had
item.
one job.
She had one job. She completed the job. But there was one thing that she was not supposed to do. And of course, she did that thing. And yes, it all hell broke loose, and yeah, wait, she was going to be excluded, but for some reason he came back to give her a second chance, and that would be, of course, if he could eat her baby, well, her brother, but we had to do an Austin Powers reference some way. And so she plots to, well, meanwhile, back in the real world, the conflict between the rebels and the fascists are just getting that much grislier. Her mom passes away, giving birth to her brother that she now has to sacrifice. And you even get the feeling that she doesn't quite get. I mean, well, you know what? That's more of a question of if this was real or not. does she understand what it is she's doing or what she's going to do?
When the Fawn asks her to bring the brother?
Yes.
I don't think she understands until she gets there.
Yeah, I think you're right too. So yeah, she has to somehow, I mean, this her brother is her father's literally apple of his eye. I mean, not
her half brother.
Yes, her half brother. He's the apple of her eye, figuratively, I should say. And he's not going to let him out of his sight. And there's just all sorts of conflict between the rebels and interrogation scenes and just fucking outright brutality. Mm-hmm. So that when the horror comes back of the fairy tale, you're like, wow, this isn't so bad. But so she connives this way to steal her baby brother to bring to the Fawn. And of course, there's a battle that rages on around this whole scene. And you could say right here, hilarity ensues. Mm. Not bad, huh? That was... that's a plot to break down. Not easy.
Well, it's actually two very cliche and simple plots.
Sure.
At the same time.
They are very basic plots that are just gnarled together. Now, I mean, what this movie did that's so unique, normally, well, take like your regular horror movie. Mm-hmm. It's normally a group of people who have everything going for them. Not a care in the world. They are just happy as anything. They're, man, this weekend is going to be so good. We're going into the cabin. We're going to be away from people. Mm-hmm. And then there's a force that comes along judging them, extracting retribution on them for being happy, essentially.
Yeah.
But what we have here are people in this shitty situation that you would not trade a second for to switch places with them. And if they were in the movie with the happy people, it would truly be a horror movie.
Yeah.
But because the elements of, I guess you could call them phantasmagoric, are actually not as bad as the shit going on in the real world, It turns it into a very bizarre fairy tale.
Yeah. Because I was a little concerned about doing this one once I watched it for our Halloween episode. This is our Halloween episode, by the way.
Yeah.
Because it's not exactly a horror film, but it also kind of is.
Right. It is, but it isn't. Like, yeah. I said, if these were people that had it all together and there was, you know, like the kids fucking getting killed, that's what mostly Western horror has been.
I'm sure there are millions of horror directors who saw The Pale Man and said, why didn't I think of that? Incidentally, Stephen King attended a screening of the film, sat next to Del Toro, and according to Del Toro, he squirmed when he saw The Pale Man chasing after Ophelia. It made Stephen King squirm. Del Toro compared the experience of seeing King's reaction to winning an Oscar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if there was really a part that was scary.
Not to me. I didn't squirm. I loved the effect, but
I was actually much more taken in by the stuff going on in the real world. Like, you know, the interrogation scene.
Yeah.
With the stutterer.
Or the wine bottle, which was really surprisingly brutal.
Oh, with the face?
Yeah.
Is that what he used to the face?
Yeah, because he found the bottle and then attacked the guy with it.
Ah, man, yeah. That is really fucking brutal. So really, the monster in the film really is the stepfather, of course.
Yes, yeah. And that's the interesting thing, because it's an obvious hero's journey. I had that from when she tells the story of the rose to her soon-to-be-born little brother.
Yeah.
I said, okay, there's the quest. It's the hero's journey. And I rolled my eyes because, as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I'm getting tired of hero's journeys.
But you're out of luck because they're never going to go away.
I know.
They will outlast. I mean, they've
They've been around for millennia. They're going to stay around. I know.
Exactly. Yeah, that was Campbell's point. It wasn't that there was a unique story in the Earth's journey.
Right.
The point of what Campbell was saying is that it's everywhere. It's in everything, and it's going to be everywhere and in everything that we do.
But okay, so at that point I realized it was a hero's journey and rolled my eyes. And then I noticed the hero and the villain are not in necessarily direct opposition like they normally would be.
Maybe the difference now is that we have writers and directors who have read Campbell and are so conscious of it and are being a little too direct to put the elements in,
Possibly.
which of course started with Lucas,
Oh,
honestly. He's
yeah.
supposedly the godfather of this, yeah, you can call it post-Campbell era.
But she's not really the hero that takes down that villain.
No, oh,
You
right.
expect her to be, somehow. And then you could argue that she does sort of indirectly, but not really.
I mean, the real thing is, she's just in the middle of this shitty situation. That's the real conflict more than anything else. It's her in the middle of this post-Civil War conflict.
Which lends credence to the it's all in her head theory.
Yes. Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, in my mind, the end spells it out that it was just in her head.
Okay, that's what I was thinking too.
Like the end, where,
Do we want to
where
spoil
she
it?
moved. Ah, let's not.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. You know what? You can't really spoil it because they show in the beginning pretty much how it's going to end anyway.
Well, yes.
It's one of the first shots of the film.
Well, just to couch it a bit and kind of explain it in careful terms, you see toward the end what you think is confirmation that it was real and there's actually this fantasy world, and then they flash back to her and it kind of gives you the impression, and not real clearly, that no, it's all in her head. It was what you saw as confirmation was just a hallucination.
I kind of wish they weren't as obvious with it, but I guess to some people it wasn't obvious enough because there's like if you look at IMDb, there's a bunch of people that are like, "Well, what was it?" That it drives them nuts to not know.
Which is a strong point of the film, because I was expecting the typical happy ending, and I don't know if I got it. I
Right.
suspect I didn't, but I'm not sure.
You got it, but you didn't get it.
Yeah, exactly.
He delivers both at the end, which is damn
Effectively.
impressive if you think about it.
Just rolling back to the beginning, and really the movie as a whole, her name is Ophelia.
Right.
That should tell us something, if you know your Shakespeare.
Yeah, but I don't really see the connection between her and, well, I guess, well, yeah, now that the victim. Yeah. The person caught between two powers
And our interpretation of her fate.
that have, well, Ophelia's a bit more proactive in her fate.
Well, yes, but it's ultimately the same.
I think this Ophelia could have moved on if she could have, if given the choice.
And also, okay, again, rolling back to the beginning. Apparently, fairies look like giant flying bugs.
It was weird because at first it looked like it was just an ordinary bug.
Like a locust or something.
Yeah. I was wondering what was going on because she showed the shape of the fairy, the drawing of the fairy to the quote unquote fairy,
And it turned
who
into
then
it.
changed into it. So I was kind of like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
And before this, they make it very obvious that the bug is following her.
Yes. There's this recurring theme throughout the entire movie about needing eyes to see that they repeat from beginning to end. And it's, oh, well, I mean, she has to put the eyeball into an empty socket. There's of course the pale man whose eyes
Are in his
are,
hands, which
well,
could be convenient in some ways and really inconvenient in other ways.
first they're on a table,
Well, that's
and
true, yeah.
he has to put them into his sockets again. To and then those eyes aren't actually on his head; they are they're on his hands, which, yeah, as you said, you can't high five anyone.
No, I was thinking of other things, but okay.
Oh well, yeah. I guess you'd get enough close to you, kind of.
But also in the scene where she has to feed the stones to the frog, I thought it was very clever how she got the frog to eat them.
Yeah, you could kind of. Well, the frog was kind of like this. I'm trying to think of the words. Slovenly? No,
It
I
was a
don't.
giant frog. It was basically what Jabba the Hutt should have looked like.
Kind of, yeah.
But she drops the stones and picks them up, and she has four all of a sudden, and then she realizes one is this giant pill bug. And she kind of tempts the frog with the bug and, making him think that the stones are the bugs, and it eats them. Could have done without the bug-laden frog vomit, though.
And the frog vomits like it's solid. It's not liquid either. It's this big giant blob. But he just, Del Toro really, when he can, he revels in the gross out splatter.
And he's done that throughout his career.
Yeah.
And speaking of the effects, it employs all three, makeup, animatronics, and digital effects. And I gotta say, that is the high point of the movie for me, is the creature work. Not just the execution, but the designs. They are absolutely brilliant.
Was the computer effect the bug, the fairy?
The fairy was a computer. I think the tongue probably was, the frog's tongue, and a few things
Yes,
here and there.
you're right.
Anything that had to move and really interact with Ophelia was probably CG.
That is definitely the way to do it. And I think the one thing I really can take away from this is why the fuck don't they have this guy doing the Star Wars
Well,
films?
I think he was up for it. He was one of the rumored names.
Well, I mean, he was supposed to do The Hobbit, which would have been awesome, I think. But I think this guy should have been the one that they did the Star Wars movie.
Also need to shout out Doug Jones, who played the Fawn and the Pale Man. Best monster actor out there. He was in John Dies at the End in one of his rare non-costumed roles.
Was gonna say, was he the meat man?
No, he was the leader of the group that opposed the soy sauce aliens.
Oh, okay.
But normally he's in a costume like he is in this movie. He played Abe Sapien in Hellboy. He does a number of those kind of roles. He's always really brilliant. He's a great physical actor. He can really figure out how a monster is supposed to move. Speaking of the Pale Man scene, okay, she's supposed to get back before the hourglass runs out, but she
Yes.
leaves the hourglass behind. How is she supposed to know how much time she has?
I don't know. I think the point was that, yeah, she had to turn it over and she only had so much time, but she dawdled.
I guess the point was she had to be as quick as possible
Yeah.
and not eat anything, which of course she does.
Yeah.
Which led to the scene that made Stephen King squirm, the Pale Man chasing her. Which I thought it was interesting. I mean, again, props to Doug Jones for the physicality of the role, but it didn't bother me or make me squirm, and I'm kind of a wimp when it comes to horror. I'll just be honest about that.
I think it was nicely done, but yeah, it just didn't get me. But then again, I'm for as far as, horror, I'm not really all that, bothered by it.
Also, she bit her hand enough to make it bleed on the mandrake root.
Oh.
The phone gives her this mandrake root that's supposedly going to make her mother better,
Yeah.
and it needs to be set in milk and then get 2 drops of blood. She bit into her hand to make it bleed. How do you do that? I mean, I understand the mechanics, but how do you will yourself to bite your hand hard enough to get it to bleed?
I mean, yeah, it's possible.
No, the mechanics work. I just don't know how you bring yourself to do it, especially at 11.
Well, I think you're desperate to keep her alive.
Yeah, I suppose. There was one head fake, or not necessarily a head fake, but something I assumed was going to happen that didn't. I got to give Del Toro credit for. I thought Mercedes, the maid, so, but or whatever she was going to turn out to be Ophelia's real mother.
Yes, I thought so too, because they look so much alike. When in the beginning they're showing the two of them together, they look a lot alike.
And I also figured she was gonna end up being from the fairy world.
Oh, that I didn't wasn't quite. Yeah, I didn't know
Neither of
about
them were
that.
true, and so I gotta give it credit for, faking me out there. Oh, about the meaning, Del Toro stated that he considers the story to be a parable, influenced by fairy tales, and that it addresses and continues themes related to his earlier film, The Devil's Backbone, to which Pan's Labyrinth is the spiritual successor.
I don't think I've seen the Devil's Backbone,
I have
though.
Not either, but it's a parable, which is supposed to have a clear lesson, and I don't know if I get the lesson in this one. I mean, I get the lesson of the captain's story, don't be an asshole.
Well, yeah, they're both sides of the coin. The captain is just a pure asshole, and Ophelia, she's not pure throughout the movie, at least, but becomes so at the end. You know, the whole lesson about not sacrificing someone else, sacrificing yourself. That I get out of the. I mean, okay. I think that's a pretty clear lesson that they do give in the end.
Now, there was an interesting choice made in the captain story when he shoots the doctor.
Yeah.
How he continues to walk.
Oh, what the? He just shoots him and keeps. Oh, the doctor keeps walking.
Yeah, the doctor just keeps walking determinedly as he's getting shot. That was a unique scene. It was kind of chilling the way he just forced himself to keep going.
I think that's what the amazing thing about this movie really is that there are these scenes that should be horrific and should be terrifying, but they pale in comparison to what's going on in the real world.
Like the captain stitching up his mouth.
Fuck yeah. That's insane.
Ophelia was no, it was a Mercedes, the maid, at one point gives him basically half of a Glasgow smile.
he could have been the Joker.
And you watch him stitch it up.
Yes.
Or if you choose. I didn't look at the screen for that scene. I got the idea.
I did. But yeah, so the stuff like the pale guy and everything, chasing after or whatever, but...
Yeah, none of the fantasy stuff made me cringe. Some of the real world stuff definitely
did. Oh, yes. And I think that was the point. Yeah. It was just that the situation they were in was just so bad that even if they were in a circle of hell, that it would have been an improvement over the situation that they were in.
Which, again, lends credence to the it was all in her head theory.
I don't know where to post this, but I found this neat blog that Serious Film, it's called, and it has a number of different stills taken from the movie, and one of them is the comparison between the pale man's banquet and the banquet that the father had with the guests, the dinner party, and how the two of them just line up. Also, it shows a still where the way Del Toro put the camera, it made it look like the fire made it look like it was coming from his head.
Interesting. I definitely would like to see that. Give me the link after the show. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, sure. It looked like the fire was coming, like there were wings of flame coming out of his head, the way he had his head in front of the fire from the fireplace behind him.
Wow.
So yeah, that's everything about this is, what's supposed to be, oh my god, here's this, creature, this fawn that's so ugly and wants to, eat the kid. But then here is someone who is supposed to be a father figure to her, but is just much
a
more
monster.
Of a monster than any of the monsters she's actually meeting.
And in the end, in that last scene, doesn't the captain see or share that scene with the fawn briefly? When he comes in, isn't the fawn there?
You know what? He doesn't see him.
He doesn't see the fawn. The fawn is there, though, right?
When he comes in, she's talking to the fawn, but you don't see the fawn.
Okay.
So they never actually meet.
So none of the real-life characters see any of the fantastical stuff.
Right. Now, there is the question, if the fantasy world is not real, how the fuck did she get out of her confinement? When Mercedes comes in, the only thing she finds is the chalk door drawn on the wall.
She found another way out. You know, doesn't necessarily mean that the chalk worked. Maybe she tried it, maybe she thought it worked. Maybe she was hallucinating the entire time and was actually finding her way out some other way.
Well, right. But I mean, how though? I mean, she's under lock and key in an attic. There's not supposed to be a way out. She's kind of in captivity with a bunch of dudes, with weapons and shit outside.
There are other possibilities
Yeah.
as to how she got out. I really want to believe the it's in her head theory. If you haven't noticed.
But the thing is, this comes from the school of magical realism.
Yeah, true. Very true.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Some people put Kafka in it, but I mean, it's traditionally known with Latino writers more than anybody else.
Yeah. Also, and then this is a slight spoiler, but not really if you're paying attention to the movie. When the captain gets shot at the end,
Yeah.
they shoot him in the cheek. Very interesting choice. Normally that bullet would go right through the middle of the eyes.
Again with the face.
Well, yeah, again with the face, but it's more, I think more realistic if you're just shooting someone from about 5 feet away. In the general direction of their face, you're not going to hit them right between the eyes. So I thought it was an interesting choice and a deviation from what you would expect, which ultimately, with the ending of this movie, is really its strong suit. It completely deviates from everything I was expecting.
Right, that is definitely the strong suit here. Is it this turns a, it takes the traditional stories, but it also turns a lot of shit that we come to expect right on its head. Like, could you imagine if, like a Friday the 13th slasher film took place in like a Schindler's List setting? I mean, where there's something terrible already going on, and then, oh, look, now there's this? What the fuck?
And it would make the monster kind of look silly.
Right, it would. It would. Like, what, dude, why, what's with the hockey mask? I don't recall, playing a game here or anything. The Quickie Mart's closed.
Take any slasher, because the hockey mask is a little anachronistic in this case, but put your average horror slasher in that setting, and they're not going to seem that scary compared to all of the guys with guns.
Yeah, when he says the smarmy line before he, goes in for the kill, the person's gonna be like, "What the fuck is that supposed to mean? Some sort of joke? That's stupid." Actually, you know what this made me think of? Because that's all I could think of about how the setting is just so altered from the normal horror film. One of the original stories of the Jersey Devil, and for those of you outside the New Jersey area, yes, there really is a legend of the New Jersey Devil that goes back to about the 17th century or 16th century.
He's our local legend. Many places have them.
One of the stories was that he had made an appearance on a battlefield during the Revolution, and like one of the soldiers claims they had scored a direct hit with the cannon, and it just kind of bounced off him, and he fucking went on about his business. What a fantastic idea for a film that would be,
Oh, yeah.
is to have this New Jersey devil tormenting these troops, beating and shooting the shit out of each other, and putting up with that at the same time. So doing something like a Grim Valley Forge type setting, although, Pennsylvania, Jersey Devil apparently was very specific to his region. Go figure. Yeah, to have a setting like that where they're under these terrible conditions trying to survive, and then there's this asshole with, different parts tormenting them.
Just another bit of trivia. The English subtitles were actually translated by Del Toro himself.
Really?
He no longer trusts translators after problems he had with his previous movies. So he actually writes out the subtitles himself.
And the title thing just has to be a dumb marketing thing.
Although he did resist pressure to make the film in English. He wanted to stay true to his idea in despite what the market would want.
I wasn't taken out by the other language, honestly. I
No,
know
not, nor was I.
there's a lot of people who do get taken aback by something that's not in English.
I used to be that way before I got really into, watching subtitled anime. Now I'm actually glad I can handle subtitles because this would have been weird in English.
I think it would have been too.
Given the setting, it's in Spain in 1944. Nobody's going to be speaking English.
You get such a better sense of performance by actually hearing their voice, even if you don't understand what they're saying and have to read what it is they mean by it. It's just so much better, I find.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, also, this received 22 minutes of applause at Cannes.
I was gonna say, and one thing for certain I can say is that these performances were fucking solid as hell.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a well acted, even down to the kid, really.
She was just as good as anybody else.
Because I had to read on IMDb what people had problems with this, and the one thing was that they didn't like her,
Really?
which I'm thinking, wow, that's actually a pretty fucking cool thing that they. It's not that they didn't like her performance; they
Oh, the
just
character.
didn't like her.
Interesting.
And you know, she's not exactly perfect, you know?
Well, no, I really didn't have an opinion one way or the other on the character. She was a kid.
Well, right. She's just a dumb kid who's trying to make sense of all this and survive, and have her brother and mom survive too. But and as she's going on, I'm thinking, you know, does she know what she's doing here? And of course the answer was no. She does not. She saw the food, she was hungry, so she ate despite the warnings.
That was the only time where I kind of, I wouldn't say I disliked her, but I kind of rolled my eyes and, of course the infamous "you had one job" line popped into my head.
Yeah, she trusts Fawn enough to bring her brother to him, but it's kind of like, you know what he's gonna do, right? Of course she did.
No.
But I think you're right. I think it wasn't until give
Until he
him to
pulled out the
me.
knife.
Yes, it pulled out the knife. Like, wait, what's that? Nothing.
Oh, also, Del Toro gave up his entire salary, including back-end points, to see the film realized.
Wow.
He did not get paid for this, basically. I mean, I'm sure he's
Wow.
made it up, since then. It's become very popular.
Yeah.
But yeah, he didn't get a salary for this, which is very impressive. It really was a passion project. And it turned out to be the movie that put him on the map.
Yeah.
Had you heard of him before this movie?
No, not at all.
Same here. This was the first I'd ever heard of Del Toro. I mean, it's possible he was well known in. Is he from Mexico or Spain?
I thought Spain, but I could be
Okay.
wrong now.
Whichever it is. I'm sure he was popular, where he's from, but in the US, I don't think anybody had ever heard of him before Pan's Labyrinth.
And this had a lot of Oscar love too, if I remember right. I don't know how much it actually won. I know it won a lot of effects awards. And why wouldn't it have?
No, that was, like I said, that really is the high point of the film. Well, before we get to that, no sequels and remakes. Let's just get straight to brains.
Well, the only remake, of course, would be is if somebody, I guess, did it in English. I don't know.
Let's just hope that doesn't happen.
And sequel, no, there's just
No,
no
there's
room.
no room for a sequel at all.
I,
Sequel would, if they attempted to pull a sequel out, it would really ruin the story.
it really would, yeah.
On to
One and
brains.
done, just like I like. On to brains.
You talked me up from a 4 to a 4.5. If nothing else, you need to see this for the effects. They are amazing. I mean, the story starts off cliche, but it really does turn around. This is how you talked me up. I was a 4 because of the effects, but realizing that the story really does subvert your expectations gives it another half brain. But if nothing else, you need to see it for the effects.
I loved how it did take very, you know, tired stories and completely flip them. And yeah, just the idea, you could tell how enamored I am by the idea of a horror film in the middle of a war zone. Yeah, if you were to do like a sequel, just have a completely unrelated, like a another spiritual sequel where it's another war zone and another monster. Or just some super normal thing happening in the middle of a horrendous situation. Yeah, I'm giving this a 5. It's yeah, the acting is just I don't know if you want to say brilliant, but it's just flawless.
Yeah, it's solid as hell.
The effects.
They are. I can't. There is no word to explain how good the visuals are in this film.
And it wasn't even just, grand effects. He was very playful too with the frog and the vomit and stuff. And then, and he also just, oh, what the hell, throw in some nasty splatter too. So yeah, it had everything. It's a five.
All right, and what have we learned?
We learned if there's that one thing that you should not do, for fuck's sake, don't do it.
Now I learned that wine bottles make exceptionally good bludgeons. All right, so until next time when we'll be reviewing movie 43. I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't either.
The reputation is hideous. It could turn out to be another Dude, Where's My Car or Last Action Hero that we like, but nobody else does. Until then, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course, the episode itself, which you're already listening to. Links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, and YouTube. Links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Also, if you enjoy the show, just spread the word. Tell people you know about it. Recommend us to people.
It would be nice to have more listeners, you know?
Absolutely.
We appreciate you guys that do
Oh,
listen,
of course.
but it would be nice to have some more.
You'll also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review up through the first month and a half of next year, I think.
Movie 43 starts a new trilogy, by the way. We haven't done a trilogy in a long time now that I think about it.
Is that a trilogy?
Yes, it is. I forgot what we were calling it.
I forgot the third one. Oh.
But it is it's kind of a shit trilogy, but it is movie it, I think it's a hate trilogy if I remember right. It's movies that people hate.
Yeah, movies with horrible reputations. I'm just looking up to see what the third one is.
Movie 43, Freddy Got
Oh,
Fingered,
I forgot about Freddy.
Howard the Duck.
I totally forgot about Freddy Got Fingered. Okay.
Yes.
Yes. These are movies that have horrible reputations. One of which you love that I kind of like, one that I remember liking.
The Trilogy of Hate.
And then movie 43 that we have no idea, and we'll find out
Yeah.
next week. You'll also find the request form. If you've got a movie you'd like to hear us review, please leave it on the request form and the recommendation list. Reputation alone, I knew this was going on the rec list. There was really no question with this.
I try to come in as blind as possible. So, I mean, Oscar love doesn't really mean a whole lot to me. And well, I was surprised to see it actually lived up to the reputation, because there's a lot of times where you see movies that get that kind of love, you're just kind of like, what? Eh, maybe not.
But it wasn't just the Oscars in my case, it was basically all of the sci-fi and fantasy community adores this movie.
That's true. And Del Toro is mentioned for fucking everything. And of course, I just added to that tonight about Star Wars, but he really should have been the guy.
You can also email us, zombietakeout@gmail.com, or leave us a voicemail at 414-368-ZTO1, or for the alphanumerically challenged, 414-368-9861. Always remember that you will always be calling from the middle of Milwaukee, and until next time, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you
There
are.
you are.
No me joda.
What's up? Welcome to episode 223 of Zombie Takeout.
Wow, I missed it. What's that happened? Never mind.
You ready? No, I'll just take welcome to again.
Okay.